Okay, so when I was a kid, on Channel 5, after school every day, they'd show the 4 o'clock movie, right? And you know, they'd have their Elvis week, or the Shirley Temple week. Pure torture. This was pre the 5,000 channels. You had to just sit there and suffer through.
When I get pulled up the big bad wolf,
but once a year, they'd have the most fantastical, bestest, most awesome week of all. Godzilla Week.
It's Godzilla!
And me and my brother, we'd run home, right? Mama, we need some popcorn. And we'd mix us up some strawberry Kool-Aid, plop down on the beanbag chair, and we'd be ready, Jack. Godzilla versus Mothra, or versus the Smog Monster, or versus King Kong. And it wasn't a Godzilla movie until they started destroying Tokyo. Fire, and x-rays, and lava, and knocking over whole city blocks, and epic fights. We'd laugh and holler, "Get him, Godzilla! Mess him up!" After the bedlam, Godzilla would return to the sea, ready to rise again for the next movie. I loved every minute of it. So imagine my delight when I moved to Japan with my brother and we discovered a country full of people who love Godzilla. Godzilla stores, Godzilla candy, Godzilla toilet paper. And then we heard about a Godzilla triple feature going down in Kyoto and we were there. Just like old times, got some popcorn, ran right to the middle seat in the middle of the theater and started having a ball.
"Get him, Godzilla! Take that, Tokyo!"
But the mood in the theater, it didn't match up with our time back in front of the TV. Even as we yelled at the screen, people around us sat quiet and contemplative. It made me think, what's going on? Are we watching the same monster? Then I watched Godzilla torch Tokyo with his radiation breath, and it occurred to me, the people who suffered Hiroshima, the people who suffered Nagasaki, they knew the real radiation breath. And this was their monster. Turns out that real monsters don't come from a swamp. They don't creep from a volcano. They don't drop from outer space. Real monsters lurk in the hearts of the people. Today on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present Monsters. Stories about creatures we would love to pretend don't exist, when deep inside, we know how real they are. My name is Glenn Washington, and this is Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. We're going to jump into it feet first. Miss Melina Williams tells us her story.
Woke up in the morning and had by my bedside table a pint of Jack Daniels ready to go first thing in the morning before I even got out of bed. I'd killed that sucker. By lunchtime, I was having a couple beers in order to keep going. And this was just the way I had accepted my life to be. I had a really close friend of mine. I broke into her house, essentially, and passed out on the couch. She comes in and is like, "Hey, Mo, what's up, girl?" And I said, "I am sick. I'm an alcoholic and I'm dying and I need help." My close friends knew, but they didn't know what to do. So they thankfully found a place for me to go, one of the few free detox centers in the US. I get admitted and immediately they put me on all these drugs to help me not die of seizures. the first night I'm there, I'm laying in bed and shaking and sweating through three sets of sheets and blankets. And as I was laying there, I looked over onto the floor on the rug, and there was this bulging bubble 3 feet across. And the bubble got bigger and bigger and bigger over the next few hours. And I'm watching the sunrise, and it's getting lighter in the room. The bubble cracked apart. And in the middle of this huge pocket was a fully grown, fully formed hyena. She kind of shook the pieces of floor off of her fur and looked up at me and said, "Hi, I'm Bubbles." And I said, "I'm sorry, what?" And she said, "Oh, yes, and you need to get up and get the hell out of here and go and have a drink." And I said, "First of all, you're a hallucination. Second of all, I'm not talking to you." And I rolled over, and she started, you know how hyenas have that weird kind of like... And she's pacing back and forth and going, "We need to have a drink right now, right now, right now, right now." Just screaming and yelling at me. And I'm clapping my hands over my ears going, "This is the worst day of my life." After the first day of this and into the second day, she got more detailed in explaining why we needed to drink. We were useless and no one cared. And if we died, that'd be fine. The next week, I had started seeing her not just in my room. I would see her out of the corner of my eye, down the hall as I was walking to a meeting, as I was going to the bathroom, as I was coming back from dinner. I would see this little brown spotted tuft zipping at the end of the hallway, waiting for me all the time. And I finally decided I was going to fight it. But she was invincible. There was nothing that would stop her. 2 weeks went by in rehab, and 3 weeks went by, and finally I was about to be discharged. And the day I was going to leave, I packed up my stuff and I walked out on Gough Street and started walking towards Market. Sunny blue skies, and I'm pulling along my suitcase and a hyena walking next to me with the claws clicking on the sidewalk and the panting, and I could feel her bumping into me, walking in that weird kind of loping, slopey gait that hyena have. And she was just pleased as hell to be outside. She's like, "Yes, this is going to be fantastic. 3 blocks from here, I know where there's a liquor store. And then 4 blocks from here, I know where there's another one. And between here and the house is at least 8. And I got to this block under the freeway where I was then approached by this guy who was obviously selling something. And the guy zips open the bag, and this man had a case of booze in his bag. Well, I have been offered all kinds of drugs on the street, I had never had someone walk up to me and try to sell me a bottle of booze. And Bubbles put her paws up on the edge and was just salivating. "Oh, this is so good. Look, you didn't even have to go into a store. It's right here. Maybe he'll give you 2 for 1. And I looked at him and I said, "I just got out of rehab. I've been sober for 21 days. No, thanks, man." And I looked down and I said, "Bubbles, no." For the next year or so, I played this game of kick the out of this hyena over and over and over again. And I'll never forget, I was sitting on the crosstown bus. And as we were having this struggle one day, I finally said, "You know, I can't hate you anymore because you're so much a part of me and you're in so much pain. What can I do to make you happy?" And I had this sensation of just holding her and having that sensation of having all of that rage and all of that anger reintegrate and to feel like we could survive as a human being, even though there was terrible evil hyena in the human being, was deeply sobering. Over the course of the next year, I started thinking, you know, actually, I want to honor her. I want to honor that part of me that does bleed and scream and ache and moan. So I went to this tattoo artist, and right now I have her on my forearm. I see her every day, and I'm able to see that part of me as beautiful. She's still here, and she still wants to run the show. And there's some days where she's really loud. There's some days where she pulls apart and turns back and goes, "Okay. Now you've done it. Now you've proven you don't have to drink anymore. So why don't we just toast to your success?" And I'm able to look at her and say, "You know, not today. Not right now. check back with me tomorrow.
Thank you for sharing your story, Melina Williams. One day at a time, and much love from the Snap. That piece was produced by Snap Judgment's own Julia DeWitt. Now, if you've listened to Snap Judgment in the past, you know that no one knows monsters like Anna Sussman. A while back, Anna decided to go and find a monster for herself.
I took a bus through Uganda and Rwanda to get here to Burundi. I'm on a mission to stalk and find a real-life man-eating crocodile named Gustav. Folks here say he's killed more than 300 people on the banks of Lake Tanganyika. Here in Burundi, there's been a civil war going on for 12 years. A genocide, like in Rwanda. Hutus and Tutsis killing each other by the hundreds of thousands. When I get here, the war is slowing down, and what I'd like to do is report on people who are trying to make peace. Civilians like doctors and teachers who are standing up to the 19 warring factions. But no one's interested in buying stories about peace. So instead, I'm on assignment to cover the story of Gustav, the 20-foot-long, 1-ton killer crocodile. Here's what I know. There have been verified Gustav sightings, and he's been filmed by National Geographic.
Gustav seems invincible. A formidable descendant of the great reptiles from the age of the dinosaurs.
He's mean-looking. In pictures, you can see 4 distinct bullet scars, 3 on his scaly body and 1 on his head. That movie Primeval is based on him. The original title was Gustav.
He has claimed over 300 victims. He is elusive, intelligent, cunning.
I have no idea how dangerous it really is to hunt for Gustav, or how safe Burundi is. So the first place I go is the U.S. Embassy, where this crew-cut military dad-type guy assures me it's not safe at all. One of the rebel groups is still at large, shelling houses in the city and shooting up remote villages. But mostly, the rebels have become armed gangsters, robbing school kids and aid workers on the roads. But since I'm here, I call up a local naturalist named Patrice Fay. He's been tracking Gustav for years.
All the crocodiles were killed, the big one. Only one stayed.
He says Gustav was like Rambo.
The Rambo.
More clever than all the other big crocodiles who've been killed off.
He's like Rambo.
Patrice agrees to take me on a hunt. I climb into his jeep and we head towards Lake Tanganyika. Convoys of white UN trucks carrying food and supplies roll by, and we pass little refugee encampments on soccer fields with families sleeping under UN tarps. It feels like a country in pieces. On the side of the road, I see a single file line of women, and each one is wearing a purple headscarf, and they're escorting a young mother home from the hospital with her new baby. And they walk quickly, with purpose. They know they're vulnerable, and they're eager to get home and shut the door behind them. On the way to the lake, Patrice takes me to a school for street kids whose parents went missing in the war. The kids are really excited about Gustav, and they sing a song about him. Don't go near the water's edge, they say. Gustav is waiting for you. And they warn me to be careful hunting the crocodile. It's not safe. The teachers at the school follow us out, and then they drag a heavy gate closed and lock the kids inside. They've all survived a decade of war, and they're not taking any chances. An hour later, We're at a remote shore of the lake. I break out my binoculars, scanning the water for Gustav.
Hold on, don't put him up. See that rock?
It's quiet, except for the birds and the hippos surfacing for air. Patrice explains that when Gustav is near, mother and father hippos form themselves into a wall around their babies. And then, there's a rustle in the bushes. And suddenly, a group of soldiers pulls up next to us. They speak quickly, and they say, we shouldn't be out here alone because it's not safe. One soldier says wild animals might stalk us, but another says rebels could be nearby. They stay close to us, clutching their guns. I'm on edge, but unsure exactly who to fear. I feel the collective uncertainty of this whole country finally clinging to safety after 12 years of civil war, like they're really trying to hold together a very fragile peace. The war began as an ethnic rivalry, but splintered into chaos, rebels killing civilians for no reason. Gustav is the same. He doesn't eat his victims, they say. He hunts for sport and leaves his victims' bodies on the sand. We don't see Gustav, so we pile back into the jeep and drive along the banks until Patrice finds a bunch of kids playing in the water.
Sometimes Gustav is coming here and ask the children, hey, Batuto, Gustav.
The kids all shout back, he's over there, he's up by the river, he's past the city, and they're all pointing in different directions. So Patrice decides to drive me to the widow of Gustav's most recent victim. A woman stands in the mud doorway of her home, and she shows me a picture of her dead husband.
Photo, Narita photo.
She's the wife?
He's wrapped up in a white sheet, and his face is swollen. He went fishing, and they found his body days later. She says, Gustav got him. But there's no way to tell. It's getting dark, and I catch a ride back to the capital with another journalist. I'm exhausted and nervous as we pass through endless military checkpoints. I think my day is over, and then it gets scary. Idling at a stoplight, a bus loaded to the seams with people pulls up alongside us, and then the passengers begin yelling at our car, screaming at us. They beat on the bus windows with their fists. And then a man on the street tries to force open the door of our car, and another man shoves his arm through my window. And then we speed off through the light, and I'm screaming, go, 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 go! We speed past the security officer at our hotel, and he closes the gate behind us. And as I catch my breath, I figure it out. The two men on the ground were trying to rob us, but the bus full of people were shouting to warn us. They were trying to protect us. I never find Gustav. And it seems clear that Gustav is used as a fable for all the dangers lurking in the bush. A way to make sense of horror and loss and to warn each other, be careful. But no one here wants to let the bad guys win. The nurses, the teachers, the embassy staff, even the soldiers, they're really fed up. And they're fierce too, guarding their children and each other and me. They're determined to keep everyone safe one moment at a time.
Anna Sussman, ladies and gentlemen, Anna Sussman. And if you head over to our website, snapjudgment.org, you can find the video that Anna and her husband produced on the hunt for Gustav. You're listening to Snap Judgment, the Monsters episode. And when Snap returns, we're getting into a shark cage. We're going to San Quentin, and one young officer is forced to take matters into his own hands. When Snap Judgment, the Monsters episode, continues. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Monsters episode. And today, we're diving into the water from whence all our fears arise. And thankfully, for our next story, we've got a guide. I'm so excited to bring him back to the show. This piece was recorded live at Oakland's Tourette's Without Regrets. Please, put your hands together. His triumphant return to the Snap Judgment Show, Mr. James Judd.
My story is called How I Made My First Friend in New England. So I was living in Los Angeles, and I decided to move to New Hampshire to go to law school. I was reinventing myself at the age of 30. And I move out in there in July, and law school doesn't start until like the middle of August. So I'm sitting in the woods in this little house. It's really beautiful. But I start to go stir crazy because I don't know anybody in New Hampshire at all. And I get a little panicky about not having any friends. So I go to Boston, and I get some sort of community newspapers, and I start looking for some sort of club to join. And I find one, the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender Scuba Club. Perfect. You may not know this, but underwater adventures are very big within the gay community. So I call up the club, and it turns out that in 2 days, they're having a shark cage dive off the coast of Rhode Island. I think, perfect, I've always wanted to do a shark cage dive, and you know, here's my chance. So I buy a map, I drive half the night, I get to this dock somewhere on the coast of Rhode Island, a little fishing village at 6 a.m., and there's about a dozen people standing next to this big fishing boat, and I go up to them, I introduce myself, and they're all very friendly. But you know what, they're all friends and they know each other and they don't know me, so pretty soon I'm just off by myself again. So I go up onto this big fishing boat and I start to take a look at the big shark cage which is on the boat. And it's about 10 feet tall, it's made out of steel, it's like a cage, no, like a cage. That's what it is, it's a cage. And it's about 5 feet wide, and except for the very large round hole in the middle of it, it looks very secure and safe. Well, pretty soon everyone is on the boat and somebody says, Mike, that's the leader of the group, Mike, it looks like everyone's here, why don't we shove off? He says, well, everyone but Meg. And the whole boat goes silent. And then somebody says, Mike, I'm just wondering whether or not Meg knows that this is going to be a mixed group. He says, well, I don't know, you can ask yourself, here she comes. Boom, boom, boom. Out of the darkness and this fog comes this giant woman, 6'4", tight, curly red hair. She's wearing a white beater. The girls are swinging free. She's got a big knife on her waist. She's got a cigarillo in her mouth. She's carrying two great big steel tanks. I mean, all she needs is like an eye patch and a parrot, and she'd be a pirate. And everybody sits down. I'm the only person standing, and Meg looks around, and she goes, I thought this was gonna be a girly boat. Everybody freezes. I'm the only one standing. I panicked. I curtsied. So the boat takes off. We sail for about 2 hours. Finally, we stop in the middle of the ocean. An anchor is dropped. And Meg and the boat captain, who's this guy with a weak chin and a mullet, they start chopping up fish and throwing it into the water. And pretty soon, there's like a whole bunch of shark fins. So Meg and the boat captain pick up the shark cage and they throw it off the edge of the boat. And then they start letting it out with like 100 feet of rope. And someone says, well, what's that about? I thought we were going to go into the cage right off the boat. He goes, well, I don't want the cage to, like, scratch up the paint on the boat. So the deal is you have to swim out to the cage 100 feet and get in. So, of course, Meg is the first one off the boat, right? And she swims out, and we know there's, like, a trap at the top. So we're waiting for her to come up and tell us, you know, what the conditions are. And we wait, and finally she comes out of the cage, and she goes, there's a whole lot of sharks in here. All right, so people go in like two by two. They're there for about 45 minutes. I realize, like my whole life story, I am the last one picked for the team. Nobody wants to dive with me. And they finally pair me up as the last group to go in with this tiny little woman named Cindy. And they hand us both a stick. And they say, so if the sharks get aggressive, first you poke it with the blunt end. And if that doesn't work, poke it with a nail. Which is like a great idea. I'm thinking, oh, that's great. I'm just gonna poke a shark with a big nail and see what happens. And it has like a little wrist strap. It's cute, you know, it's kind of like a stick with a nail. So Cindy and I jump into the water and we swim out as fast as we can and we get in the cage. We just don't look around. We don't do anything until we get in the cage. And we lock the cage and we stand there with our sticks. And a couple things. By this time, it's pretty late in the day and the boat has basically run out of chum. And there are more sharks in the water than anybody could possibly count. And these are blue sharks, 6 to 12 feet, maybe the average age, about 450 pounds. But they might as well be the shark from Jaws, because they got like crazy eyes, and their teeth are like... And it's terrifying, and they're everywhere, right? Okay, so you know how I mentioned that hole in the front? That is for video cameras to go into. But we don't have a video camera to block the hole. So this one like sort of small shark just suddenly it swims into the cage and it gets stuck right over its head. And it's looking at us, you know, one eye after the other. And it's stuck. And so I'm like, what am I gonna do, right? So I take my wrist strap off of my stick and I tie it to the side of the cage. And then I gently sort of press against the face of the shark until it swims free. I'm like, woo, all right, I did it, totally butch. So, right? Okay, so then I'm like, that was exciting, right? And I look down and I see that in all the excitement of, you know, pushing the shark, I have basically sucked down an entire tank of air that should have lasted an hour in about 5 minutes. So I look to Cindy, who's like in the corner clutching her stick like that. And she has like 1,500 pounds of air. So I realize I'm gonna have to swim back to the boat alone. So I look around and my stick is gone. So I look to Cindy and I try to sort of pantomime, where's my stick? And she sort of gestures this way, and I see that my rope has come loose from the shark cage, and my stick is now floating away. So now I've got to swim back to the boat with no stick. So I open the cage, and I step out. I start to swim toward the boat. And then I see this one really big shark with a piece of chain hanging out of its mouth. And it's trying to tear the ladder off the boat because there's no chum left, right? And sharks like shiny objects like ladders and the weights that we have around our waist. So I hover, right? And I just sort of wait. Miraculously, the shark lets go. It swims away. I think, oh, perfect. Well, it turns out it wasn't really leaving. It was just making a U-turn under the boat. And then it starts coming at me. And it gets closer. And it gets closer. And then pretty soon we're like nose to nose. So I did what people say you should do if you are ever nose to nose with a shark. I bunched up my fist and I just hit it in the nose as hard as I possibly could. Right? And the shark goes like this. And it's freaking out and it swims away and all the other sharks freeze. They're like, oh my God. Oh my God, I can't believe you just did that. I'm panicked now. I stick my head up out of the water and I look onto the boat and the only person standing in the boat is Meg. And she's looking over the edge of the boat and she looks at me and she says, yeah. So I swim back to the boat as fast as I can. She reaches over the boat. She grabs me by the back of my tank. She yanks me up onto the dock. She throws her arm around my neck and she goes, this guy just punched a shark! This guy right here just punched a freaking shark! She takes a beer bottle. She bites off the top. She goes, open your mouth. She starts pouring it down my throat. Now the boat captain is pulling back the cage with Cindy still standing in the corner holding her stick. And Meg puts her arms around me and the boat sails for home. And that's how I made my first friend in New England.
James Judd, the San Francisco writer and performer. James Judd is the force behind his popular one-man show, 7 Cents. His new solo work, Funny Stories, is now playing across the country. The man is hilarious. Do not miss it. That piece was produced by Jamie DeWolf and Renzo Gorio. Nobody told me it was sharks in the water. Next up on Snap Judgment, we get to bring you another fantastic performance storyteller. She asks a very serious question when the world has labeled you a monster. can you ever claw your way back to being human again? Kay DeMartini tells us her story.
It's this sunny morning in March, and I'm driving to a courtroom in L.A. I want to see the trial of a gangster who's charged with kidnap and murder. His name's Armando. He's 35 years old, and he's been living in prison for the last 9 years waiting for this trial. You see, I know Armando. At least I think I do. And that's why I'm here today. We've been writing letters for over a year, but he doesn't know my name, my address, he's never seen my picture, he doesn't even know my gender, and that's the way I want it. When I first wrote him, I didn't sign my name, and he wrote back to me and he said, "Everybody in prison has nicknames. I'm going to call you 64, since that's your P.O. box number, and I don't know anything else about you." In our letters, we write, we don't discuss his crime, we discuss a book and his ideas. The book is The Four Agreements. I read it about 10 years ago, and it changed my life. So when the Four Agreements started this prison program, and it's writing to inmates who want a study partner, I volunteered. And it wasn't long after that that I got a letter in my P.O. box, and it was addressed to a resident. I opened up the letter, and inside, Armando introduced himself, and he started out by saying, "I would like to find some peace before I die. Everyone says if I pray, I'll feel God's presence, but I don't. Do you have peace? I've been waiting for my trial in prison. It's been 8 years and the last two in isolation. Some guys get sent here for a few days. I live here. A rabbi and minister used to visit, but they got tired of me. If you Google me and decide not to write back, it's okay. P.S. Does it matter that I'm never going to get out?" So I Google search the hell out of him. The crime's horrible. It's a messy, botched scheme. It ended with an innocent man getting shot in the back. There's this huge high-speed chase, and three gang members are captured, and they've all been tried and convicted, except for this last one, Armando. I try to pick him out from those photos, but I can't. But what I do know is that I don't want anyone from any of those pictures ringing my doorbell. So I decide if I'm going to do this thing, if I'm going to give this letter writing a try, then I'm really going to be careful and super safe. The less he knows about me, the better. So the letters start coming, and he writes me 2-3 times a week, and they're always in pencil, and his printing is in little tiny letters. But in contrast to his handwriting, his thoughts and ideas are mature and deep. Sometimes he'll write and he'll veer off, and he'll discuss what he calls DP. And I know he means the death penalty, but he never writes out those words. He'll write to me, "64, what difference does it matter if I'm becoming a better person if I never have the opportunity to help someone? Isn't it all pointless?" So I write back, "Maybe a time will come when you least expect it, and you'll be able to show what you've learned. Don't give up now." That Wednesday morning, when I enter the L.A. courtroom, it's the first time I see Armando. He is sitting facing away from me. He's a small, alert-looking Hispanic man, glasses, blue shirt, goatee, and there's a large tattoo across the back of his bald head. "Flats," it says. That's the name of his gang. The judge dismisses everyone, and I catch up in the hall with Armando's lawyer. "I just want to talk to someone who knows him personally. I want to know, really, if Armando is the same guy I know from his letters that he is in person. I want to know if I'm getting conned." I tell him I'm a friend of Armando's, and could I talk to him for a minute? So his lawyer stops walking, and he turns around and he says, "How do you know him?" So I tell him about our anonymous writing relationship, and he laughs, and he says, "Really? He doesn't even know your name?" You know, in your situation, if you took the stand as a character witness for him, you could maybe save his life. And I tell him right off, "No, that's not why I'm here. Look, he's a gang member and he's a criminal. Our deal is we write letters. What you're asking would change everything." So his lawyer says, "I've been an attorney for over 40 years. and I've never met anyone like him. You know, he's the youngest of 9 kids, and his mom used to beat him. The reason he doesn't have any other character witnesses is because he's been in jail his whole life. You know, you really should talk to him yourself. No, I'm not meeting him, and I'm not taking the stand. We don't do this personal stuff. We write. That's our deal. It ends there. I leave. I fly home to San Francisco. And I can't sleep. One side of me is afraid of making a big mistake, letting a monster in my house, my life. And then there are those words that keep coming back from our letters. The words that say, if all the love is on the inside, what difference does it make if you don't act on it? Armando does get the guilty verdict, and the sentencing trial starts. I make my final decision to be a character witness. I email his attorney. I'm in. Then I get a letter from Armando. 64. My lawyer says you're coming to take the stand. You should not do this. You will have to say your name, and I know you do not want to do this. Thank you for offering to help me, but it's okay. Please, you can refuse to come. I fly to LA. I wait in the hall outside the courtroom and enter when the guard tells me to. When I do say, my name is Kay DeMartini, I kind of choke on the words. You know, I protected this information for so long, it's hard to let it go. And then I take the stand and I tell the jury everything I know about this man with a horrendous childhood who has mentored me in spiritual lessons. I study the 12 jurors and I can't read their faces. The prosecutor then has his turn at me and it gets ugly. He paints me as a pathetic cliche, a lonely single woman looking for attention. He takes parts of Armando's letters and reads them out of context. I get angry, the judge gets involved, the public defender steps in. It's a circus. A week later, I get a phone call from his attorney telling me Armando got the death penalty. Maybe I was a problem instead of an asset. Then the letter from Armando comes. And in it he says, Dear 64, I want to thank you for coming to LA. You are the only one at the trial that mentioned I've been in isolation for 3 years. That meant so much to me. I hope you will still write me. And can I still call you 64? It's nothing personal. It's just that this is how I know you. I hope it's okay. These days I write less often to Armando because he's only 40 minutes away and I can visit him at San Quentin.
Kay DeMartini is a storyteller who hosts the event Real Stories Bay Area once a month. We're going to have a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. And when we return, monsters lurk everywhere. Keep it locked right here. Snap Judgment, the Monsters episode, will return in just a moment. PRX and NPR, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Monsters episode. We're exploring that place from whence come monsters. And I asked one of our favorite storytellers, the performance poet legend Jack McCarthy, to tell us his story.
In the late 70s, I was part of a Bible discussion group led by a young, tall priest with the brooding good looks of the young Montgomery Clift. The women of the parish had dubbed him Father, What a Waste.
I love you, Michael. I've always been in love with you. I know it's wrong. I can't help it.
Do you understand? I chose to be what I am. I believe in what I am.
Father was a Vatican II person, all about forgiveness, reconciliation. I remember somebody saying of him, "For one who has no darkness in himself, he has the best understanding I've ever come across of the darkness in other people." I also knew Father from my teaching Catholic Sunday school to a handful of hormonal public school boys who saw my classroom as a holding cell. The only way I could maintain any illusion that learning was taking place was by sending my discipline problems to Father What a Waste. One night when they were giving me a really bad time, I gave them an ultimatum. The next kid who opened his mouth would be sent to Father's office. And of course, the next kid that did was the best kid in the class, John Fernandez. John didn't want to leave my room. I had to haul him out physically. Father happened to be patrolling the hall at that moment, took custody of John from me a second before I might actually even have struck him. Another time, Father was visibly upset when he arrived at our Bible discussion group. One of the women prodded him gently, and finally he admitted that he had just caught a boy to whom he had entrusted his keys, borrowing quarters from the Coke machine. He felt deeply betrayed. Someone asked, with only the slightest hint of taunting, if Father had forgiven the boy. After a long pause, he said, "Give me 3 days." In one of these Bible sessions, we talked about the forgiveness of sin. How could murderers be forgiven? Rapists? Father saw their crimes as products of a long string of decisions, where maybe the only decision on the string that involved free will was the first one. And maybe in God's eyes, that first decision had no moral content, yet determined everything that followed. Primed to nail Father, I asked, "Then what's the difference between a sin and a life mistake, like taking the wrong job or marrying the wrong person?" He had obviously thought this through before, and he answered simply, "There is no difference." That shut me up real quick, plus gave me something to wonder about down all the years since.
Father, come with us.
Father What a Waste subsequently got his picture in the paper over a report that the institute that deals with pedophile priests had discharged him as an untreatable sociopath. And that set me thinking again about him and the difference between a sin and a bad life decision. I know he must have done the kind of things he was accused of, but I still believe that Father What a Waste was a good and maybe even holy person when I knew him, though the reason he was so understanding of the darkness in others was he did indeed have a darkness of his own, growing very slowly, like a cancer that eventually consumed his entire beautiful spiritual being. I pray for him every day. I pray for all the priests, especially all the many who never laid a hand on anyone. I pray for the victims. And I say a special prayer for John Fernandez, whom I had to drag out of his seat, and for all the discipline problems I handed over to Father What a Waste from my class. Most prayers are aimed at things we cannot know about the future. This one is for things that I don't want to know about the past.
Jack McCarthy, His work has appeared in a number of anthologies, including The Spoken Word Revolution and the film Slam Nation. Jack currently lives in Seattle, Washington. That story was produced by Jamie DeWolf, Renzel Gorio, and Mark Ristich. Now then, as every true monster hunter knows, no Snap Monster episode will be complete without a trip to New Mexico. Cisco Guevara brings us this story from the land of enchantment.
Back in the day, the U.S. government got together the greatest minds to build the atomic bomb. They found a little town up in the mountains. They actually dumped a lot of toxic things out into the beautiful canyons. There was a beast, probably had been poisoned by some kind of toxic chemical or radiation that the scientist had inadvertently dumped into the canyons. But everybody knows that it comes out of this one certain extra deep canyon called Arroyo Aguaje. A lot of people couldn't pronounce the Spanish word, so it became known as the Guaji Monster. And all they knew that it was big, it was white, and it was horrible looking. The Guaji Monster. It would make an appearance at night, usually by taking somebody's pet out of their backyard and just leaving a splotch on the porch where the dog used to be. This went on for several years, actually. One day, a call came into the police department. There was some shenanigans going on at the local cemetery, and police were very frustrated. And so this one officer in particular, he decided, well, I'm going to show these kids. I'm going to really take care of this issue. And it just so happened that the cemetery is right at the entrance to Arroyo Aguaje Canyon, where the Guaji Monster lives. It was late at night, and he was cruising down in here, and he turned off the motor of his car and coasted in so he could surprise these kids. Very carefully opened the car door, stepped out of the car very slowly. He was listening to the sounds of the night to see if he could tell where these kids were and what they were up to. Nothing. So he started moving out away from his car, and that's when he started thinking about, oh, this is Arroyo Aguaje Canyon. The Guaji Monster lives here. The hair on his arm started to stand up as he thought about it. His hand went down and unclipped the holster to his pistol, just in case. He got a little more nervous, and he actually pulled the gun out of the holster just to be a little more secure. And then he heard a noise. A very strange noise. And he turned, and there it was. A horrible, huge monster face with big, wide mouth, with teeth and huge, wide-set, glowing eyes. And what did he do? Shot his car. The grill of the car looked like a mouth in his scared state, and the headlights looked like big, wide-set eyes. And in his fear, in the dark, he actually shot his own car. True story.
Big thanks to Cisco for sharing his story with the Snap. Remember, be careful out there, because danger lurks. That piece was produced by Rita Daniels, Madeline Shalita, and sound design by Pat Lacidi Miller. You've been listening to Snap Judgment, the Monsters episode. And don't worry, there's plenty more Snap where this came from full episodes, music, movies, all available for your listening pleasure, snapjudgment.org. Whether you missed part of the episode, catch us on iTunes, Facebook. Our Twitter handle is snapjudgment.org. Snap was produced by myself and the most magnificent, mighty, monster-making miscreants in Mayberry. Flap your wings for the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Pat Mesiti Miller knows not what he does. Jamie DeWolf battles monsters every day. Anna Sussman doesn't have a dark side. Stephanie Fu does have a dark side. Julia DeWitt is incubating some sort of strange, multicolored egg that did not come from a chicken. Renzo Gorio knows the night. And Will Urbina says he does not believe. Did you ever show up to work and find that guy wearing some sort of dragon monster slippers instead of regular work shoes? Don't contemplate too hard. That's just the Corporation for Public Broadcasting taking this whole casual Friday thing way too far. No worries. Much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, putting the public in public media and stuffing public media into the public, if you know what I mean. PRX.org. And this is not the news. This is not the news. In fact, you could go to your favorite coffee shop, order a drink from that attractive barista, but notice, when she accidentally scratches herself with your credit card, for a brief moment, you saw green scales pulsing underneath her exquisitely toned flesh. You could see all that, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.